Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins, and I'm delighted you've taken the time to listen. First up, a very warm thank you to my Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in sponsoring me, I'm doing an online concert purely for my sponsors on Sunday, May the 22nd, which will be Saturday evening in North America. I've put a link in the show notes to take you to the page where you can sponsor me, patreon.com/Dan Mullins. We're drifting toward winter here in Australia. Not that we have a very demanding winter here in Sydney. It's a very mild climate. Very rarely would we ever get to zero even. But I've toyed with the idea of walking a winter Camino. Indeed, when Bill and Jennifer Bennett and I shot the film clip for Somewhere Along the Way, the Camino song, it was late April. It was very cold on the Camino. There was snow in Burgos and snow on the Meseta. So we're going to talk about winter Caminos this week, and we'll get to that discussion in a moment. But first, this is a podcast about El Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James. Pilgrims walk alone or in groups, hoping to make their way to a crypt housing the remains of Christ's apostle St. James in the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela, St. James under a field of stars. I've only walked two Caminos. I walked maybe a mile or two when we shot that video back in 2018. Don't think it quite constitutes a Camino. And I'm told the Camino is very busy this year. Border and travel restrictions are all but gone. And unfortunately, there are lots of albergues and small businesses along the way that didn't survive COVID. So there are not as many places to stay. But let's hope it can one day return to its full vigour and vitality. Just this week, I had lunch with a friend from school, and he was visiting Sydney, and we quickly slid back into our friendship of old. It was nice to be in the company of someone who knows you so well that you can truly relax. We all build an identity. We shape ourselves, or our view of ourselves, the view others see, and sometimes the real us, you and me, is kind of hidden. And that's a great shame, or maybe the real you or me wants to remain hidden. To meet that person would fill us with dread. Well, I think of the almost 280 episodes of podcasts I've conducted here, coming up to 6 years, I'm constantly reminded of pilgrims who found themselves on the Camino. I often ask, did you like what you found? And inevitably they say, yes, even if, as many concede, they've made mistakes. They've hurt people. They've not been their best selves, the best version of who or what they want to be. But perhaps, if by accepting your mistakes, your stumbles and even falls, and then forgiving yourself, telling yourself not to dwell on the past but to look forward to joys and triumphs to come, the new you will step up, will emerge, will envisage a brighter future. And it's not just you who'll get to bask in that brighter light, but those around you too, those you love and who love you. But first, the courage to forgive ourselves. Well, the Camino is a great place to start. St. Francis of Assisi, who himself walked part of the Camino, said, "It is in pardoning that we are pardoned." My guest this week has walked two winter Caminos and one in spring. I'm intrigued by the concept of a winter walk when it's perhaps not so crowded. Jordan Ozero is on the line from Canada. Welcome, Pilgrim.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to our talk today.
Yeah. How's life in Canada post-COVID, man?
Well, we're coming out of it, I think, pretty much like the rest of the world. And spring here is really quite magnificent right now. So a lot of people out and really enjoying the weather and trying to find a little normalcy again.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do? Where do you live?
Well, I'm on Vancouver Island on the west coast of Canada. A little town called Nanoose Bay, which if you don't concentrate, you'll drive right past us. But I've worked abroad for the last 20 years. I'm a veteran of the cruise industry. And in my time off, I've had the good fortune to be introduced to the Camino and spend three tries on it.
Right on. The cruise industry. So I'm imagining the cruise industry has been completely wiped out, has it?
Well, it sure was. I stepped off a ship on March 5th, 2 years ago. And today, I think about 95% of the ships are back online and sailing around the world. Some are still a little restricted, but it's going, and it's exciting for the industry to be back. There's a lot of pent-up demand for it.
Yeah, good luck to them. Good luck to them, because people who love to cruise certainly love to cruise. You're doing a thesis at the moment on the Camino and the phenomenon of transformative tourism. Now, I haven't heard that term before. Is that a new term to describe a very old pastime?
I don't think it's particularly new. I think it's been the framework for a lot of thesis. My master's is in tourism management. So I really, I went back to the original tourism. That was religious tourism. You know, we're back hundreds of years ago when people started touring the world, or at least the continent. Normally it was Europe. And I've tried to put a modern spin on it. As all your listeners will know, the Camino goes back about 1,200 years, and it was predominantly a religious event in the life of people. But over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a pretty significant shift away from religious motivation into what is sort of termed spiritual, or it can be entirely secular in the motivation now. So that's the spin I've taken, is really trying to understand what catalysts exist on the Camino that really inspire people to go there and to have what we would call a transformative event take place on the Camino.
So when you study this, what are you trying to eventually produce? What will it be, an opinion piece, or will it be a kind of explainer? What will you end up with?
Well, I think with this this research paper, it'll be more aimed towards a case study. And it'll be information and research that has been put together through literature reviews. I'll be doing some digital ethnography, you know, in today's world. Social media is a great influencer in venue for sharing information. So gathering that that ethnography through the digital means will be an important piece. And then I'm going to do a series of interviews. There's no shortage of people out there that love to talk about the Camino experience. So I'm looking forward to having that opportunity to really get into what experiences they had and what brought about those transformations in their own life.
Just take a step back. What is ethnography?
What you're looking at there is really the environment of the people, what they're going through. So ethnographers, typically you're dealing with the field of anthropology, where scientists will go in and study people and environments and societies and cultures. So I'm taking that sort of spin, because I think the Camino is really about the people. And looking at the culture of the Camino and what aspects and attributes it has that can have a profound effect on people.
Wow. I mentioned in the introduction about forgiveness. To me, it's a very important aspect of transforming. There's no point papering over the cracks. If you're going to hope for change, you need to acknowledge that perhaps you need to change. What have you learned about the process of transformation in the journey of your study?
Well, I'll tell you, Dan, you can read about it, but I think you have to experience it. And because I've been on the Camino a few times and gone through some personal transformation, it really gave me that insight that it was there, it was relevant, and a lot of people want to know about it. So it really fills a gap in research that hasn't really been explored in academia.
Wow. I imagine everybody's story is different, yet I'm sure there's also a familiarity to everyone's journey. Would that be fair to say?
100%. absolutely 100%, because we can get to a point of data saturation where we interview 20, 30, 40 people, and you'll see very strong common threads emerge as you do these interviews. But to each one of them, it's unique and personal. From an overarching view, you'll certainly see trends. I have no doubt I'll find those in my research, but it certainly is a personal journey that maybe millions have gone before you, but it's still your first time. So it's still very relevant.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's certainly been my experience here. I could do another 500 interviews. It fascinates me. Everybody, it really does. I just think it's terrific. I generally record on the weekends. Go up into my studio at home and you know, might do two or three, even four interviews back to back. And by the end of the day, I'm like, wow, they were so varied and so incredibly different stories, yet all on the same path. And that is just, sure. It's astounding.
And you can usually pick a little of yourself out of all that too.
Of course you can.
It's so easy for us to relate to them because, you know, everyone has commonalities and to find those connections, I think that's what makes the Camino so special is you bond to people over these connections that you form and the commonalities you have, regardless of the language you speak, your religion, where you live. And that's one of the true magical things about the Camino.
Sure is. Wow. One of the other great things about the Camino is the walking. So it's the get up every day, walk, eat, sleep, repeat. What about the physical nature of pilgrimage? Have you done any research or learned any insight how the effort required to walk, say, the Camino, where you'd expect to walk 20 or 30 kilometers a day, how does that effort contribute to transformation?
I think it's a profound part of the Camino experience. You know, pilgrimage can have many formats. There's nothing wrong with flying to a location like a Jerusalem or a Rome and being on pilgrimage. But I think when you add in that element of the physical effort, I believe there's a strong meditative aspect to walking that allows us to get away from the conscious and slip into the subconscious. And I think that's one of the things that makes it a little unique from other pilgrimages.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. What other forms of transformative tourism are there?
Well, you can look at a lot of things in the broad spectrum of transformative tourism. In my industry, when I was on the cruise ships, for an average person who's never traveled abroad a lot, they get the opportunity to step on a ship and go to five countries over the course of a week. That exposure, that acknowledgement of different cultures and different ways transforms people. So whenever we step outside of our norm, and that's, you know, really the definition of tourism is when we leave our immediate area for a non-work purpose and explore new areas, or even if it's, you know, longer term, like maybe a work contract, we're still getting out of our normal. And when we go and do in those areas, we can't help but be transformed at some level. Is it conscious? Maybe not, but maybe that's the differentiation between regular tourism and the Camino or religious tourism, is that we go often with the understanding or hope or desire that we will have a transformative effect or event.
Wow, that's fascinating. I love that. Let me ask you a personal question, Jordan. Are you religious?
I don't think I am, Dan. I certainly fall into the agnostic category in most senses, but I'm not going to say I'm there 100%, because when I go to the Mass, which I attend often during my Caminos, I can't help but feel moved by that. And you know, I'm deep enough in the agnostic camp that I still need a little more to get me to that level that I would call myself a religious person. But I certainly have feelings when I'm taking part in the Camino.
Yeah, good answer. And I ask that question because I saw recently that you posted on a Camino group that I'm also a member of, that you're researching what involvement, both financial and non-financial, the Catholic Church has on the Camino, aside from the pilgrim office and the relics within the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela. Tell us about that aspect of your research.
Well, that was sort of an earlier iteration of my thesis work where I was looking at a slightly different angle, but it still fascinates me, and I've had some very good conversations with people. A gentleman you know well, John Rafferty. You know, we've had that discussion and tried to understand, or I've tried to understand, really what the involvement with the church is outside of those immediate places, like the cathedral in Santiago with the relics, like the pilgrim office. And it's really an interesting idea because, unlike so many things in life, the Camino isn't a tangible place. It isn't regulated by anybody. So it's kind of a unique idea that it's a heritage site, per se, from the United Nations, but it's not a managed site. No one has ownership over that domain. So sort of understanding a little deeper how the church is involved is still important to my research.
I'd imagine, though, it would be almost endless research, wouldn't it? I mean, we're talking, like you said, 1,200 years. There's intrigue and corruption. I mean, just walking through a cathedral like the one in León blows your mind. I mean, and Burgos, forget about that. You could virtually research it forever, couldn't you?
I believe many people do. yeah. Unfortunately, with my research, I have to limit the scope, and that's probably the hardest part for me, Dan, is really narrowing that scope enough to keep it to a single topic. Maybe when I go on and do my doctoral dissertation, I'll be given a little more latitude, but it is fascinating. I mean, you think about Burgos being constructed over 300-400 years and the changes in the world during the construction of a cathedral. Your mind has trouble getting around that.
What I find difficult to work out is what or when they said it's finished. Like, right after 300 and something years, one day someone says, I think we'll be finished this tomorrow.
Yeah, fair enough. I think they just ran out of real estate is the problem.
Right. Yeah, right. It's an amazing place. Amazing. And the cathedral in León, I have, there's a little cafe directly opposite it, diagonally opposite. And the pilgrims come up the street and into the albergues. There's a couple of albergues lining this street there. And I often sit there and just look at the cathedral because it's truly one of the most beautiful buildings I've ever seen. But you were lucky enough to be there, and I'm fascinated by this, during a blood moon.
Yeah, that was a fun night. And one of my real passions in life is photography. And I was, you know, when you walk a Camino, of course, you can't help yourself to some degree for counting the ounces. And when you're carrying a 6-pound camera and regretting the fact you didn't have an extra 4-pound lens to capture the moon, you know you've got it bad.
Those photographs are unbelievable in your blog. They are just stunning. Oh, what a night that must have been.
You know, it was beautiful, but that particular night, the moon was great. The cathedral was great. I've sat in that same cafe that you have eating gelato on the corner there.
Yeah.
But honestly, the most exciting part of that night was not the moon or the cathedral. It was the fact I ran into a young Australian woman and an American pilgrim. And she and I had met online on Ivar's Camino Forum website and been talking about Winter Camino. And lo and behold, I meet her in Roncesvalles, and then again I meet her in León, and the chance to see someone that you've chatted with online from around the world, to me that was an amazing experience.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right, let's talk about Winter Caminos 2014 and 2018. You sent me the picture of a sign outside Roncesvalles. Everybody knows it. 790 kilometres to Santiago de Compostela. The snow is 3 or 4 feet deep. Tell us, Jordan, what happens when you can't walk the actual Camino because there's too much snow?
Yeah, well, it's happened to me a number of times over the years. It was actually 2013 I walked the first one, and I left from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port. And the first half of the Camino, of that stage was green and beautiful. I thought, this is great. Reminded me a lot of back home. And shortly after Val Carlos, because, of course, the Napoleon route is closed, shortly after Val Carlos, I take off into the alternate route up through the trees, and the first couple of snowflakes appear. About a half hour later, I was over my knees deep in snow and going up an incredibly steep section under the power lines, and I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? This is now actually bordering on dangerous. So at that point, I got to the end of that trail, and I zigzagged up the road all the way to Roncesvalles from that point on. And, one of the fun things about Spaniards is they all have the DNA of a Grand Prix driver, and the snow doesn't slow them down a mile per hour. They drive very fast, so I would have my head on a swivel, and whichever side of the road they were on, I would jump immediately to the other side and get off as far as I could. But you really have no choice going over the Pyrenees and a few other places where you have to just abandon the Camino trails and just stick to the hardtop.
Right. And so then I suppose the problem then becomes that there won't necessarily be albergues in the towns that you're in, so you've got to sort of get back to the Camino eventually.
There was never really a point where I couldn't be in the town or city that I wanted to be in.
Okay.
So my diversions, the road effectively takes you to the same place as the Camino Trail.
Sure.
So it was winter, of course, so a lot of albergues are closed. But the reality is that I got to those towns safely, and I never had but maybe one night where I had to move to a different town. I was always able to find accommodation.
And were they albergues that you stayed in always, or pensions or hotels?
A little bit of a mix in the winter months.
Right.
I've lived and died by the Brierley Guide, and always been thankful for his contributions, because the albergues and the phone numbers he puts in there are updated every year. And there was really no difficulty getting on the phone and calling ahead to find an open albergue. As I say, maybe one town, I couldn't find the one that said it was open. It was not open. And so I just walked another 4 kilometers down the road and found one that was open. So, 300,000 people won't be able to do it in winter because most of the places do shut down. But for the 10 or 12 of us that I met on the Camino, there was never a problem at all.
Right, that was my next question. Did you see many other people? 10 or 12, that's not many at all.
No, not the first year. Well, I walk in January, right? So if you look at the bar graph of when people walk the Camino, you have those great big lines in June, July, August, September, and there's a little pencil mark at the bottom of January that says, Jordan walk then. It's really a quiet time.
So when you walk in spring or summer, you can stop every half hour basically for coffee or food or a beer or whatever you want. What about in winter?
It needs a lot more planning. And with a big part of your gear, you have to plan very differently. Now, one of the biggest surprises I had that totally went over my head when I was preparing was the lack of water. Spring, summer, and fall peregrinos, they're used to having water all over the place, good public fountains with clean drinking water. But in the winter, they shut all those off. They don't want the pipes to crack.
Oh.
So a lot of places I went to, and I knew there would be water ahead, there was no water. I knew there was a little tienda I had, and they were closed. So there was points going up Alto del Perdón, for example, where I had to take a bunch of snow and put it in my canteen or my my drinking container and work to melt it so I could actually get some hydration in me, because that whole day between Pamplona and Punta Lorena, there wasn't a single place I could get water.
Wow. Okay, so one of the things that is great about the Frances in spring and summer is that if you think, I've got a bad blister, okay, there might not be a pharmacy in this little town, but there'll be one in the bigger town or even the city a day or so later. Were the cities and the bigger towns like Astorga and I suppose Laroño, were they open and trading as normal?
Yeah, there was no problem with that.
Right.
If you're looking at the small little towns like a Valcarlos or Ascheta, these places you could run into those kind of problems. But as soon as you're in a bigger town or a city, the locals still have their pharmacies, their restaurants, their bars. So that was normal enough. The challenge might be when they're open. You know, they don't have the same hours available to us, but at some point during the day, if you're desperate, they will be open, and it's up to you to figure that out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because sometimes you might have another couple of days of painkillers left, and you know, I'll buy some today, so I'll wait for the pharmacy to open. You know what I'm talking about. So we talked before about forward planning. What about before you arrived in Spain? Did you plot out, I'll stay here on this day, I'll stay here on that day, I'll stay here on this day? Or because of the nature of snow and the uncertainty of which and where you're going to travel, you sort of had to do it on the run?
My first Camino in 2013, I didn't have a lot of background. I hadn't found the Camino Forum website at that point. And I was pretty much reliant on Brierley's guidebook. So, I know it's a popular theme now to not stay in his endpoints, but I took that as my gospel. You know,
yeah.
Brierley says, "Thou shall go to Roncesvalles, then I shall go there." and, that made it easy. Being a Canadian growing up, walking in the mountains with my dad all the time, snow was not new to me by any means, and hiking certainly wasn't new to me. So that I would walk 20 or 25 kilometers in foul weather really wasn't too much of an issue. So it was something I was easily able to deal with, and I just used Brierley's book, and that really helped get me right across the country.
So what about the simple things like keeping your feet dry?
I'm a West Coaster. One of the great things about the West Coast is it doesn't get real cold, but it gets real wet here. So all my gear was designed to deal with that. And I also took a bit of a belt and suspender philosophy with me too in the first one. So I had a great Gore-Tex raincoat. I had great Gore-Tex rain pants and great Gore-Tex boots. And then on top of that, I took an extra waterproof poncho. So wet really wasn't much of a problem for me the whole way.
Is it slippery?
Some places are crazy. I ended up on my butt a couple of times on the first one. Black ice.
And the leaves are very slippery.
Coming down Alto del Perdón was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a bunch of places it was pretty bad, and that was a learning experience. And the next winter when I went on, my wife said, you're taking your ice trekkers. And I objected a bit at first because I just didn't want the weight of having to carry something I was going to use three or four times. And in the end, she was absolutely right. I ended up using them a lot more than I thought I would. And it's sort of the theme of a winter Camino is you have to think differently, you have to pack differently, and you just have to be prepared for those kind of events without, you know, carrying your fears. You don't want to go overboard with it, but there's certain elements that you're out there by yourself a lot more. So you need to be a little more self-sufficient and maybe be a little more cautious than you would if you went other times of the year.
Yeah, yeah. And you just mentioned there that you had to take extra gear. So how much heavier was your backpack in the winter Camino as it compared to the spring Camino?
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to tell you the first one, but I was well over 30 pounds on my first winter Camino.
Right.
I was introduced to the Camino by Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez, and I was prepared to not die in the Pyrenees. And that meant I took a waterproof bivy with me. I had crampons for my boots. I was loaded for bear. So that first pack was probably about 34 or 35 pounds.
Wow.
By the time I got to Logroño, I jettisoned about 10, 12 pounds ahead to Santiago. So I think it's not an uncommon thing when people go for the first time and you're a little unsure and you err on the side of caution.
Yeah. So if you are walking in inclement weather, and even though you are decked out, how hard is it to dry your clothes in the evening to be fresh and dry when you kick off again the next day?
Mm. I didn't find that really much of a challenge, to be honest, because the Gore-Tex gear, you hang it up by the door anyway. The albergue people don't want you bringing all the wet gear in. So that dries off and it drips, dries easily overnight. And, you know, I think when you focus on layering up over your body with a base layer, a thermal layer, you might have to swap out your base layer more often, but your thermal layer isn't going to get wet. And as long as you use the right gear, you know, I use normally a thin weight merino gear in the winter for base layers, and it dries remarkably well. No odors to speak of at all, and just really convenient.
So if you're walking, let's say you're going to walk 20 kilometers in a day, and you've got all that gear on, aren't you getting very hot underneath it all? I mean, you're walking and you're strenuously walking because you're carrying a very heavy pack.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to my upbringing. Because I spent so much time in the mountains with my dad growing up, that heat management is just something that becomes instinctual. As you get a little warm, things get taken off, zippers opened, and you never really allow that heat to build up to a point of perspiration. As it cools off, it's easy to slip a layer back on. And I guess that's really the crux of the difference between a summer Camino and a winter Camino.
Yeah.
Summer, you throw your shorts and t-shirt on, and that's how it is all the way to the end of the day. But winter Camino, some days I started off, it was -4, -5 Celsius. So you had to start with a little extra warmth underneath. And maybe after a kilometer or two, you have to stop, drop your pack, take off a layer, walk another few kilometers. As the temperature comes up, you're taking off another layer. And you just adjust throughout the day. But you know, anyone that spent any time in cold weather knows the worst possible thing you can do is perspire. That's the quickest way to hypothermia.
Yeah, right. So how mindful do you have to be of the weather? Are you constantly checking to make sure that you're not going to get snowed in, or is it even a possibility anywhere other than, say, O Sobrero? Are you always mindful of it?
I think that's a good practice. Personally, I say that because people listening might not be experienced in that kind of climate. If it's your first time in that kind of climate, having a good weather app, watching the morning news before you leave a place, if you go to the bar for a coffee in the morning, and just getting a sense of what's ahead is pretty important. If you're thinking about some of the stretches like maybe Burgos to Hontanas or Carrion de las Condes to Santo Domingo de la Cueza. These are long stretches, yeah. And in the winter, you're almost guaranteed to see nobody. So if God forbid anything isn't great out there, you're kind of on your own. So a little planning is smart, having the right gear is smart, and being cognizant of your surroundings is always an important part.
Did you have to take emergency supplies with you? Did you always have food with you just in case?
Always. And it wasn't a lot. You know, I would have a few bouillon cubes and a pack of dry noodles. From that, you've got a chicken noodle soup. All it takes is a pot and a little bit of boiling water, maybe a dried chorizo and a little bag of nuts. And you don't need a lot. Even in really dire circumstances, you don't need a lot. You just need enough to keep the fires burning, and the next day you'll deal with that. I can remember one stretch coming, I guess it was up to Os Sobrero. Nothing was open. Mm. No tiendas, no restaurants. The municipal albergue was a self-serve event at that point. And so I went without dinner. And I couldn't find a place to eat for about three quarters of the next day until I found a place open. So, you know, my little chicken noodle soup and a handful of roasted nuts. And that's enough to get you by. It's not great, but it's all you need.
Yeah. So because there were fewer places open, did it cost you more, the Winter Camino?
I guess I don't have a true basis of comparison there. Having just walked once in the spring with my wife, I didn't see a big difference between spring prices and winter prices. In the big cities, I would always stock up in grocery stores. There was always a dia, and every dia I hit, I ended up with a cold roasted chicken, and that would last me for days. And so I don't think it was any more expensive, to be honest.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that's great. Yeah, actually, I was reading your blog, and you said, and you talked about your cameras. Mrs. Peregrina says the next Camino will be photo-free. The photos are beautiful. You can tell it's a very nice camera. One of the photos is from the Meseta and the planted forest. And you say the OCD in you loves the forest, but the son of the lumberman couldn't get over them being lined up in such perfect order.
Yeah, I think with those, they're a crop. And out here in Canada, we don't really have specific tree crops like they do, where they're having a short growth period and harvesting and replanting. You know, our trees out here grow for hundreds of years and they grow wherever they want. So that was kind of an interesting place for me to see. I'd never seen that before. And it took me quite a while. I don't know if I'm used to it yet, to be honest.
So we've talked about transformative tourism and the changes that the Camino can bring to us. What about transformation for you, Jordan? What sort of change have you encountered yourself?
Well, I think that was really the driver for my first Camino back in 2013. I mentioned that for 20 years I've worked on cruise ships, and for anyone that's been on one, you'll know that you're surrounded by anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 or 7,000 people on a floating steel ship. The life of a worker on the cruise ship is quite different than people understand, I think. You work every single day for your entire contract, so there's no days off. In my position, I was typically working 11, 12, 13 hours a day. And responsible for quite a bit of the operation going on board. So I'd done that for years, and the cumulative stress that had built up in me over that period was quite significant, and I was really in a burnout stage personally. And I think that was really it struck me when I saw that movie the way the, you know, I watched the character of Tom evolve and how he really changed himself, entirely different circumstances, of course, but seeing that evolution and his character really spoke to me, and it put me on the Camino, and I had a choice. I could do it in the winter, or I could wait 6 months, and I could have done it in July. And I chose winter after some brief research on the Camino because I wanted the time alone. And it was the first time in at that point in probably 10 or 12 years that I hadn't been around people and a lot of people. And having that opportunity to spend time with myself and listen to nothing, you know, just nature. You know, I really tried my very best to not be on any devices or watch any TV for the entire Camino. And that one, I just wrote my blog in a, not a blog, I wrote my journal on a in a book with a pen because I didn't even want to, you know, blog anything electronically on that one. And I think that was a significant experience in my life. And I don't know how many people need it, but I think there's a lot of people that do, and they don't necessarily know that it's there or the benefits of having that kind of long-term experience where you can really allow yourself to change, to find out things about yourself and let them come up, bubble up from deep within, because you get rid of all the external stimuli. You don't have to worry about day-to-day work issues. Your biggest concern is walking, eating, washing your clothes, and going to sleep. And when you rinse and repeat over and over and over, it takes that element of your life away, and it really allows you to let change happen. And I think that's that catalyst that I spoke of for my research work that I want to delve into a lot deeper.
And did that surprise you, that this change in you?
No one was more surprised than me. I guarantee you that. And I think it's when these kind of stresses build up in life, it's not noticeable easily. You know, it builds up slowly, incrementally, and it, you know, it's sort of like putting on a new pair of shoes. It isn't until you try the new shoes on that you realize how poor the old ones were. And I think our lives are like that. Until we have a chance to rejuvenate, like really rejuvenate, and really replenish our energy and build up our strength again, it isn't until that point that we realize how beaten down we were. And I think that's one of the great bits of magic on the Camino.
Do you think it's for everyone, the Camino?
I've not yet met anyone that isn't. I've been invited to do lectures on the Camino, and I've talked to husbands who were reluctant to come up to me at the end and say, this was everything I didn't know I needed. So I think it is for everyone. I think the Camino is so diverse, and the way you can approach it is unique. You know, thinking back to Hap Kirkland's book, I'm Off Then, he talks about a couple who she would walk a few kilometers a day, and the husband would gently and patiently wait in the car for her to arrive. And, you know, that's how she worked her way across Spain. And I think there's something there for everybody. And I just can't imagine who couldn't benefit at some level from the Camino.
And I suppose that leads perfectly into my next question. What about if you don't want to change? If you don't want to be transformed, can it be for some people that they are transformed against their will almost?
I'm not sure. You know, of course, I haven't been in that pair of shoes, so it's hard for me to be certain. But I think the very physical act and the routine, it brings something out that we don't necessarily understand or know. It just happens. It's a transformation in itself. And I think, you know, not everyone needs to change. there are a lot of normal, high-functioning people in the world that are very happy with their lives, and this is a vacation for them. So, you know, not everyone goes through that level of transformation, but as I said in the beginning, whenever we get away from the normal and we experience new things, to some degree, we are transformed. So you may not want it, but I think to some degree it'll still happen.
Yeah. How fantastic, Jordan. My gosh, this is such a great chat with you, such great insight. So what's next on the horizon for the Camino for you? Are you going back again? Are you going to carry a camera again? What's next?
Well, it depends if I'm going by myself or with my wife. So, you know, if I go by myself, the camera will come with, because I do love capturing that and sharing that. And
yeah,
that brings a lot of joy to me and to the people I share with. I can't imagine a life without the Camino in the future. Oddly enough, I don't have a great desire, like some, to explore every single Camino route. People ask me where next, and I kind of default back to the Camino Frances. It's everything I need and everything I want.
Yeah.
You know, I don't speak fluent Spanish by any stretch, so I have some hesitation to going some of the more remote routes where it's from the understanding I have, you're asking people, do you mind if I sleep in your house tonight? You know, and as an English speaker, I think that would be a little awkward. You know, the Camino Frances provides everything I need. The distance, the people on it are wonderful people. So there's definitely more Camino in my future. And, you know, the phone is still debatable. The camera is still debatable.
Okay, one last question. Tell us a Camino story.
Okay, well, you know, it's always nice to make other people feel good about themselves. So my story is on day one of my first Camino, 2013. You know, I've gone to great lengths to tell you I grew up in the mountains and I knew how to navigate in the wilderness. So day one comes and I'm leaving St. John Peter Port. I'd met a couple of chaps. One was from Italy and one was from Portugal. And the Italian was on his third or fourth Camino at that time. So I was hanging off his every word. I mean, this is great. I have someone that knows things. It takes a lot of the insecurity away. So off we set at about 7:30 in the morning from the municipal albergue. And being January, of course, we're taking the Val Carlos route. And for the people familiar, about 1.5 kilometers outside of St. John, you have to cut across a bridge to get off the highway and to go up the route on the other side of the river. And I'd surged ahead a little bit, and I was, it's still dark at this point, and I was stopping to take a quick break, and the Italian and the Portuguese man caught up to me. And I'm looking at my guidebook thinking, well, I should probably turn here, but the Italian says, no, definitely, we're going straight ahead. You see that little red and white mark on that post? That means we're on the right route. I'm like, oh, well, third time, can't be wrong.
Yeah.
So we keep hiking, and it's a beautiful walk. Oh, God. You know, beautiful country roads up in the mountains of the Pyrenees. Couldn't have been more picturesque. But about 3 hours into the day, I'm thinking, well, you know, it's only 13 kilometers to Val Carlos, and at the speed we're going, we should have already been there. So I catch up to Sirio, and I said, I think there's something wrong here. He says, yeah, I'm starting to feel that I haven't seen any of these places myself. So I got out my compass. I came prepared, and I'm laying it on Brierley's guidebook map, and I can see in the distance the valley of the river goes up, and I said, Sirio, we're so far off the Camino right now. We ended up stopping a farmer, and thankfully Sirio also spoke French, who said, oh, well, no, Val Carlos is about 20 kilometers in the other direction.
no.
So as it turned out, we had gone exactly the wrong direction crossing the bridge. And by the time we walked all the way back to the bottom and then up the valley of the way we're supposed to, I'd walked just shy of 30 kilometers to do that first 13 kilometer stretch. And, you know, my hips were on fire, 35 pound pack. And we couldn't help but laugh. And a few minutes later, the door opens and the Portuguese guy comes in because he was a fast walker and went way ahead of us. And he was probably 25 kilometers away from the albergue. And, he knocked on a farm door to say, you know, ask the people where he was. And they took pity on him. So the farmer's wife drove him all the way to the albergue in Val Carlos. So, you know, it's people laugh and say it's impossible to get lost on the Camino Frances. You know, there's too many arrows, too many everythings. And I'm here to tell you that it's possible.
We've all been lost. I walked 12 kilometers further than I had to. And I thought that was enough, but that's a great story, my gosh. And on the first day of your first Camino, you must have been thinking, what have I got myself in for here? But here you are, studying transformative tourism and really researching. And I might add too, Jordan, providing some terrific insight throughout the course of this interview. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you. Good luck with your studies. And don't hesitate to sing out if I can help in any way. I have met a few and talked to a few pilgrims over the years. I know a few people who might be able to help you. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been such a pleasure. Buen Camino.
A real pleasure speaking with you, Dan. Thanks very much for having me on, and buen Camino to you too.
My guest this week was Jordan Ozero, a Canadian pilgrim who, as it turns out, is also doing a thesis on transformational tourism. And I'll put a link to his blog in the show notes. Remember, your journey to transformation will include forgiveness. St. Francis of Assisi, who himself walked part of the Camino, said, "It is in pardoning that we are pardoned." Thanks again to my Patreon sponsors. I'll be doing an exclusive online concert for my sponsors on Sunday, May the 22nd, which will be Saturday evening, May the 21st, in North America and in Great Britain and in Europe. I've put a link in the show notes to take you to the page where you can sponsor me, patreon.com/Dan Mullins. Until next week, thanks for your company. Buen Camino.